This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Dan Lefkowitz, strategist for Morningstar Indexes.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning for Morningstar.
Our guest this week is Sonali Peer. Sonali is a managing director and portfolio manager at PIMCO, a global leader in fixed income based in Newport Beach, California. Sonali is lead manager for the PIMCO Diversified Income Fund, which carries a gold rating from Morningstar, and she co-manages a number of other strategies, including PIMCO High Yield and two ETFs. She serves on various committees at PIMCO, and she was honored earlier in her career as a rising talent by Morningstar's manager research team. Prior to joining PIMCO, Sonali was a senior credit trader at JP Morgan, and she has a bachelor's in economics from Princeton. Sonali, thanks so much for joining us on The Long View.
Well, thank you, Dan and Christine, for having me.
Absolutely. So you're a very accomplished fixed income investor, and these are interesting times for the asset class. PIMCO put out a 2024 outlook called Prime Time for Bonds, and it noted how compelling fixed income is right now relative to equities. Now, we are hitting new highs in the stock market in February 2024. Why so bullish on bonds?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if we look at what's occurred over the last couple of years, you know, we endured the steepest rate hiking cycle in decades, and that essentially put fixed income in the spotlight. You know, we do agree it's absolutely the prime time for bonds. As we've reset yields higher, fixed income can help navigate a number of macro scenarios, right? Essentially, the income in the bonds is more reliable and predictable than the equity returns at this stage. You know, given while base case may be that, you know, we have 4% nominal GDP through full year 2024, and, you know, growth is coming down, inflation's coming down, and we do expect the Fed will probably continue to hold at restrictive levels and start cutting around mid-year. So our expectation is we may have 3 cuts. You know, while there is still potential for a mild contraction in the U.S., that is our base case, the one I just painted. And with that backdrop, you know, we're generally favoring an up in quality tilt. So one that, you know, in our portfolios, we're trying to keep up on the upside and protect on the downside with more resilient investments. You know, most importantly for fixed income investors, they stand to potentially benefit from the cuts in 2024 and potentially in 2025. And I think it's an important time to start owning that yield and terming out in fixed income. And credit provides an opportunity as well to enhance yields.
So we want to delve into some of those themes that you just mentioned, as well as PIMCO's outlook on some of these matters. But one, I think, thing that's top of mind for a lot of investors is cash versus bonds, where you see cash yields in some cases right in line with bond yields today. And of course, we've seen flows go into money market funds as well because of those attractive yields. So what are investors missing in cash versus bonds? And is it PIMCO's view that investors are overdoing cash instead of bonds?
So money market funds or cash broadly, it can be a great investment at certain points in time. But investors, you know, that moved into money markets and T-bills and CDs throughout 2022 were rewarded, right, as cash had elevated yields. But those instruments are not designed to be a medium or a long-term solution. When you buy a money market bond, you're renting that yield. You're not buying that yield because it can change quite dramatically. For example, in 2024, we are expecting rates to move lower. And so instantly, you're kind of reinvesting at lower yields if you're in a cash-like instrument. And you don't capture the price appreciation associated with the rate cuts without some duration or credit risk as well, where you term out that fixed income investment. Being invested outside of cash may have been painful in 2022, but, you know, today we've reset those yields and investors can enjoy the potential returns from rate cuts as well as the income that these higher yields are generating today.
So you mentioned the reset that we've had in rates. 2022 was, you know, termed by some as the worst bond market ever. We had double-digit losses for core bond indexes. And some advisors and investors concluded that the best way to own bonds is to kind of skip bond funds and purchase individual credits and hold them to maturity instead. What should people know if they go that route? What do you think they miss by not owning a fund?
So I can see the temptation, but really diversification is so important for investors, especially as volatility increases or you hit pockets of stress. You know, when we look at a multi-sector credit strategy, for example, we're looking to diversify across risk factors and, you know, find alpha from asset allocation, regional selection, industry selection, security selection. So there's a lot of ways, you know, the market's dynamic from which to not just generate alpha, but also have the most efficient expression. The strategy you're describing, that kind of passive ladder approach, can work well in a low vol environment, but, you know, it gets very difficult when there's stress in the market. Imagine, you know, you own 10 bonds in that scenario and one or two have an adverse outcome that would be worse than the high yield default rate that we see currently in the market, for example. You know, and as we look ahead, we see stress potential in the credit markets from things like, you know, liability management exercise, creditor on creditor violence, that, you know, again, it really depends on the specific bond you hold and, you know, the holding period as well. So, you know, I think of this as the market's dynamic and that latter approach is static. So when we look at, you know, what you miss from it, I would say you're not really going to capture the trends of the market and the evolution, right? So an example would be, you know, if we look at the high yield market today, 35% of high yield is secured. If only a few years ago in 2020, it had about 20% of secured bonds. So, you know, another way to put it is over the last 5 years in this asset class, the benchmark has had close to 50% turnover. So, you know, it is an evolution and you don't capture that evolution by buying the single bonds and holding them to maturity.
I wanted to ask about 2022 specifically, Dan just did, but it must have been a tough time to be a fixed income fund manager. Can you talk about some of your key kind of takeaways or lessons from that experience and also whether there was anything that surprised you during that period?
Sure. So 2022 was a tough year for all investors across both fixed income and equities. You know, we had the fastest rate hiking cycle we've seen in decades, and correlations dramatically increased across asset classes with rates rising and credit spreads widening. And, you know, essentially one of the takeaways is you need to be nimble and pivot quickly to respond to a newer environment. So having that liquidity and flexibility in a portfolio is very important. But today, the situation is quite different, right? Rates have reset higher. The opportunity set looks attractive for bonds. And, you know, we're trying to take advantage of that opportunity, but still cognizant of, you know, scenario analysis, not just modeling for the base case, but really how would our portfolio perform across quote unquote fatter tails. You know, at PIMCO, we value the behavioral economic aspect throughout our investment process. And, you know, we try to limit our confirmation bias or appreciate the probability of those tails that I was mentioning when we're looking at opportunities in the market.
Getting back to current market dynamics, we have an inverted yield curve. It's been inverted for some time now, I think since late 2022. It's often cited as an indicator of recession. Do you see it as predictive? What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because often people will cite, well, if it's inverted yield curve, we could have a recession. But the reality is, every time we've had an inverted yield curve has not necessarily meant a recession. However, recessions are typically preceded by a yield curve that's inverted. You know, inversion at this point, you know, we are still seeing relatively low unemployment, inflation overall coming down. So, you know, I think there is a path for the Fed to see a soft landing, you know, especially as I shared earlier, you know, our outlook is for rate cuts in the second half of the year. The market had been pricing, you know, more cuts than our outlook. And we believe the Fed will stand firm on restrictive rates until inflation is a bit more consistently low. And, you know, at this point, the market seems to be pricing in a bit more in terms of cuts than our base case. But, you know, we see it as a second half event. And, you know, when we look at the probability before June, it just seems the economic data has been quite strong. And so, if we were to evaluate what happens if rates were to remain elevated, I guess that's the other side of it, you know, I would be concerned about some of these low margin, low multiple businesses that have low free cash flow and, you know, also some areas of the floating rate market, like some parts of the bank loan market and some parts of the commercial mortgage market where there is a bit of stress already. But again, you know, it's case by case, meaning you have to be selective within each of these asset classes.
So we wanted to delve into the health of the economy a little more deeply. You know, as you mentioned, there have been some sort of mixed indicators. The job market is strong overall, but there have been a lot of layoffs, especially in, I think, the technology sector. We've heard about the vibe session, and there's also the rolling recession concept. I'm wondering, with your perspective looking at the corporate credit market, what do you make of the rolling recession concept, and what are the investment implications of it?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? So the rolling recession concept is essentially that you don't have an instantaneous or ubiquitous negative shock, right? So very different from what we experienced during the great financial crisis. Instead, it's like pockets of weakness or stress that can impact one sector at a time or one geography at a time. In terms of what we're seeing in some of our areas of concern within the corporate credit segment, you know, again, this goes back to sort of that high capex, low free cash flow theme and the sectors that that's affecting. You know, we're seeing it already in telecom, media, and cable. And then even outside of corporate credit, in some segments of real estate, for example, within office commercial mortgage space, office CMBS has repriced meaningfully, although it has started to see some green shoots in certain spots. You know, the key is essentially to stay diversified and be selective with such exposure and, you know, have that active lens on it.
So following up on the property market, we've seen some tremors, as you mentioned, in commercial real estate. You have exposure to residential in your portfolios. Could you kind of take us through your view on real estate these days? Obviously, when you're investing in mortgage-backed securities, you've got your agencies and your non-agencies. So what kinds of differences are you seeing across these markets?
Sure. So let's start with the residential. You know, I think we are at a very different point than, say, the great financial crisis. You know, I get asked that sometimes because of rates being so high and the stress that could be putting on the market. But residential housing is in a much stronger position today, and lending standards are notably higher as well than during the GFC. Most homeowners have a very low mortgage rate. In fact, over 65% of American homeowners have a mortgage that's below 4%. And that stands in quite some contrast versus the adjustable rate mortgages that we saw in the GFC. So the strength in housing pricing has created also a large amount of equity cushion when you look at people in their homes. In fact, you know, some of the issue is there's limited supply and people are kind of stuck in their homes with these low mortgages and, you know, therefore there's less transactions taking place. You know, we do prefer non-agencies because the borrowers are in a healthy position, as I mentioned, and especially in the legacy non-agencies where, you know, our PIMCO analytics is quite impressive. We have the ability to look at how much home equity has been built there, how many years people have lived in that home, you know, what their track record has been in paying and the level of mortgage to have a fair amount of confidence in, you know, the forward trajectory for those legacy non-agency securities. We also find agency mortgages attractive as it's liquid, it's implicitly guaranteed by the government and offering a spread that's quite similar to, say, single A investment grade. So that certainly has been attractive across a number of portfolios here. And then within commercial mortgages, I would say it's just important to be selective. You know, we've had some headwinds in the space in terms of work from home dynamic, in terms of interest rate increases, as you mentioned earlier, the tech layoffs. And so within commercial mortgage space, we're mostly looking at some of the loss remote AAAs. And then, you know, within industrial and hospitality, there's some opportunities. And then I would say very select and, you know, case by case. So again, going back to that idiosyncratic risk within credit generally around the office space.
We wanted to ask about investing in fixed income globally. You're a global investor. I would say PIMCO as a firm has long looked at fixed income globally and offered, obviously, global fixed income funds. Many investors take a global approach to their equity holdings, but stick with domestic bonds. And I think the general thesis there is that the bonds are the safe portion of their portfolios. So it's unwise to take added risk there, especially currency risk. So maybe you can tell us, what is the case for taking a more global approach to fixed income, not just being global with equity holdings?
Yeah, so essentially it's back to that diversification point, right? So investors can consider opportunities across regions, currencies, asset classes. And today, growth cycles are quite divergent, right? And when you look at our economic outlook, U.S. growth could differ even amongst developed market countries, right? So, for example, Canada and Australia, they have a shorter dated floating rate mortgage market, and so much more sensitive to rates rising, whereas in the U.S., as we talked about, the mortgage rates that were fixed lower, but also for longer with the 30-year mortgage as an option in the U.S. And so today we're seeing a lot of differentiation between economies, especially based on that, sensitivity to variable rates. And we'd expect those, with more sensitivity to grow essentially at a slower rate. But even when we look beyond that in emerging markets, for example, while we do prefer developed markets over emerging markets at the moment, there are some select countries in emerging markets that have actually been ahead of the cutting cycle than developed markets. And so there's opportunities kind of abound. It's just much more on a selective basis. And then, digging into it in more of a micro level for alpha opportunities across the capital structure, we see companies issue sometimes in dollar or sterling or euro and, in the same capital structure. So where there's incremental spread or, certainly after compensating for liquidity differences, we will look across those currencies and look for opportunities. Similarly, we say we're looking for those singles and doubles and alpha, using that most efficient expression of a trade. So whether we're screening for a cash bond versus a derivative, a dollar bond versus a euro bond, or the front end of the curve versus the long end of the curve, however we can kind of craft the portfolio to be able to benefit the most from the opportunity set that we see, we want to do so. And so, our approach is a bit different than U.S. or global, and just really kind of taking all of that into consideration as we build a portfolio across the global credit landscape.
Maybe we can talk about how your global outlook is filtering down to your portfolio positioning. So you run a multi-sector credit portfolio and you're weighing opportunities across investment grade corporates and high yield corporates and emerging markets debt. How are you assessing the risk return profiles of those various asset classes?
Yeah, so certainly, essentially we want to be able to take advantage of the structural inefficiencies in each of these asset classes, but also tactically flex when markets move. So meaning rotating across asset classes or industries or regions. And so when we look at these risk factors, some of the themes we're looking at today is, as I mentioned a little earlier, developed markets over emerging markets, although there are some select attractive opportunities in emerging markets, certainly. But, developed central banks have likely reached the end of their hiking cycles. We're discussing cutting, by mid-2024. When we look across, the liquidity profiles also tends to be better in many parts of developed markets. And so I would just say that the bar for EM exposure is a little bit higher as we look at that, but certainly finding some opportunities in there, whether it's in sovereign, quasi, or even corp space as well. Within regions, we do prefer the U.S. over Europe at the moment, as the U.S. economy has not only been fairly resilient, it is also less rate sensitive, as we discussed. And, when we look at some of the geopolitical risk, whether that's Middle East or Russia or trade sanctions with China, I think Europe will be a bit more sensitive to that disruption. Shifting to, corporate credit markets, within investment grade, we do prefer financials over non-financials. Some of the backup in spreads, in terms of financials versus non-financials occurred as a result of some of the regional bank stress that we saw last March. And today, if we look at, for example, the Big Six, there are large, diversified global multinational banks that are offering attractive spreads given the need to continue to issue. And so that's kind of provided some new issue concession as well as incremental spread versus non-financials. In terms of kind of instrument selection, we do look at derivatives and prefer CDX at the moment versus some cash bonds, given the basis in many cases, meaning the spread between derivatives and the cash is actually positive, meaning the derivatives trading wider. So that's kind of from a tactical basis, attractive at the moment. But from a structural perspective, it's also providing better liquidity carry and roll down. And it allows us to really sort of rotate the portfolio when bonds are oversold and you hit a period of stress to be a kind of a price maker rather than a price taker, right? Because we can rotate out of the derivatives and actually provide a bid for the bonds. Shifting gears to agency mortgages, you know, we discussed those being historically cheap and certainly part of the portfolio at the moment. We also like agency mortgages, you know, they're trading quite wide in OAS terms, but also, you know, given the liquidity profile, the implicit government guarantee, and at this point, the levels look quite similar to, say, single A IG credit. So a diversifier from a spread perspective and a pickup in liquidity as well. You know, tying this all together to valuations, you know, admittedly, spreads are on the tighter end in corporate credit, but it's balanced by those wider yields, right, which can absorb some spread widening, some interest rate increases, although that's not the forecast. And so that income comes back into the picture. And, you know, I think we can find interesting opportunities across investment grade, high yield, EM. It's just about being selective and really kind of digging in, doing the work credit by credit.
Yeah, that's a really helpful overview. I want to delve into emerging markets bonds. You mentioned that you generally have a preference for developed and are being more selective in emerging. We've seen some enthusiasm among contrarian value investors like the team at Grantham Mayo Van Otterloo, who call EM bonds a once-in-a-generation opportunity. Some emerging market central banks were ahead of the Fed and the ECB, you know, raising rates early in 2021, and they're now cutting. So maybe you can talk about how you are looking at the asset class, emerging markets bonds.
Sure. So, you know, in emerging markets, just like any of the other credit markets, it's absolutely idiosyncratic and case by case. And so, you know, as you mentioned, you know, some EM economies like Chile, Brazil, Hungary have been ahead and are cutting already ahead of the developed markets. So there's certainly selective opportunities that are attractive across, you know, sovereign, quasi-sovereign, and, you know, in our case, off benchmark in local FX and corporate space as well. But when we look at it overall versus developed markets, you know, and versus the index of emerging markets, say hard currency external, you know, some of the tighter trading countries like in the GCC, you know, we can kind of substitute that risk with high quality developed market corporates and avoid, say, the geopolitical risk or have a bit more total return potential. Other areas within EM that were a bit more cautious is in kind of the lower quality portion. Now, again, it's, you know, there are some opportunities that we find attractive in that space, but overall, you know, liquidity is quite constrained, especially if things do not work out. You know, so that's something we're very mindful of, as well as are we getting compensated for that incremental risk? And so when we look at the total portfolio within emerging markets, you know, I would say the sweet spot has been more of the triple Bs and double Bs, but, you know, absolutely kind of diving into where is the best expression across EM asset classes and then, you know, comparing versus DM as well.
Turning to high yield, high yield had a big year in 2023. Investors really got rewarded for taking on credit risk. Our high yield index was up almost 14%. How are you approaching the high yield space?
Certainly. So the high yield space has improved in quality as well. So part of those returns are due to, you know, we've had significant rising stars. So in 2023, we had $125 billion of rising stars. So companies going from high yield to investment grade. In 2022, we saw $113 billion. So one aspect is the migration of the high quality credits, the double Bs going up to triple B status. The other aspect is actually, you know, when growth turned out to be better than expected, right? 2023 was rather resilient compared to forecasts at the end of 2022, calling for a hard landing in many scenarios. And as a result, that really helped the triple C portion of the high yield market also rally. And, you know, that's really what led to those strong returns. But even today with compressed spreads, the yield cushion of high yield can really provide an opportunity from an income perspective, as well as from a industry selection perspective and a security selection perspective. So meaning looking up and down the capital structure and across industries. So, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about some of the stress in the cable and wireline spaces and high yield. Similarly, when we look across industries, even within correlated industries, for example, we do prefer building materials over home construction, given it's a bit more of a consistent free cash flow theme and less cyclical and less tied to, say, a big housing market cycle.
I had a bigger picture high yield question, which is, you know, I think some investors see high yield as equity-like and maybe even a superfluous sort of asset class. There have been lots of blow-ups in the past, although not too many in the recent past. So why do you think high yield is worth the trouble?
Yeah, I think actually high yield is a great asset class to own through a cycle, right? The income profile from those elevated yields helps also to bolster the returns. You know, at today's levels, especially compared to cash, you know, the income starts to become important for investors. And it helps absorb some of that underlying price volatility. Essentially, what that results in is a bit more resilient of a total return profile than investors may expect, given, you know, often that discussion around defaults. Today, our outlook for defaults is roughly in line with the long-term averages, given many companies termed out their debt when rates were low, you know, given the amount of uncertainty that was out there in the back half of 2020 and in 2021, a significant amount of longer-term debt was raised. And so when we look at, you know, even if you look at it by rating cohort, for example, just as one metric, you know, the median default rate for double Bs is about 0.5%. For single Bs, it's 2%. So the bulk of that default rate is really in the triple Cs. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, our preference is a kind of a higher quality tilt, and we're being very selective when dipping into the lower quality parts of high yield. You know, if you look at it through history, for example, you know, high yield has not had two consecutive years of negative total returns. 2023 was a good example of, you know, where valuations and returns were very challenged in 2022, especially due to the rising rates. You know, we bounced back quite strongly in 2023, and especially the bulk of that was in the last quarter. So, you know, if I compare this versus equities, I'd say, you know, high yield returns on average, we've seen over the last 20 years, returned 6.5% with 9% volatility for a Sharpe of about, you know, over 0.7. And versus equities, you know, over the same time frame, they've returned 7.5%, so 1% more, but with close to 15% vol. So the Sharpe is just 0.5. So, you know, when comparing the two asset classes, I'd actually say, you know, high yield's a bit more of a resilient equity-like proxy.
We've seen bank loans and private credit rise in prominence. They're two asset classes that are related to high yield. How have they impacted high yield?
Yeah, there's absolutely been significant growth in both the bank loan market and the private credit market. Today, all three markets are similar size, yet the growth trajectories have been quite different. So the bank loan market's doubled over the last 10 years. The private credit market has doubled over just the last 4 years. You know, it's kind of helped high yield actually improve in quality, because over the last decade, you know, we talked about those rising stars, but there's also been limited net supply more recently as, you know, the debt stacks had been termed out. And so there wasn't really a need to refinance while rates have been at, call it, peak. In contrast, the loan market has deteriorated in quality as it became a primary capital source for LBO financing with its constant prepayability at par, meaning sponsors found it quite attractive to be able to have that option to prepay at par, where typically in the high yield market, there would be a structure where it'd be a non-call 3 years, and then at that first call date, it'd be par plus half the coupon you have to pay, so both time prohibitive and cost prohibitive. Adding to it, the CLO growth has been so tremendous that it's led to significant growth in the loan market of loan-only structures, asset-light businesses, covenant-light growth. And so, you know, you have to be quite selective within that asset class. As we look at private credit, you know, some of its growth has been due to providing a partnership, right, with a small number of holders as lenders that are looking for control, but also can provide issuers with some insights through portfolio companies. So altogether, all three are about $4.5 trillion and converging to some extent. And this is having an impact on spreads, structural protections, and defaults. So let me explain and highlight a few examples. the growth of the private credit market, you know, we see that all over the headlines. And they've taken significant share of LBO activity. This has partially been responsible for improving that credit quality we talked about in high yield, as some of these issuers that are lower rated, single B or triple C, and, you know, are no longer in the high yield benchmark because they've been refinanced in private credit. The growth in private credit has also led to large multi-billion dollar deals where there's also sometimes a public and private piece to that transaction. You know, these prepayments address near-term maturities and have also led to negative net supply in public markets. You know, this has been a very supportive technical to secondary prices, given credit fundamentals have also been stable. You know, today, there are many times where PIMCO is providing a price based on whether it's a public or private deal and showing, you know, kind of a dual track option to issuers. You know, the private credit, importantly, has provided really a lifeline for some of these B3, CCC type credits that would have otherwise had to default or led to maybe a distressed exchange in the high yield or bank loan markets, essentially doing their dirty laundry for them. In fourth quarter 23 alone, we saw approximately $20 billion of public transactions refinanced that were near-term maturities with low rating profiles. You know, again, going back to kind of solving for what either would have been difficult for the loan market to digest, given, you know, CLOs have to mark to market in excess of 7.5% triple Cs, and they own about 70% of that loan market. So it's been quite interesting how private credit has kind of become a solution and allowed all of credit to perform perhaps better than some expected from a default perspective. And today, you know, I would say the open question is how the secondary market will evolve as private credit continues to pursue large multi-billion transactions and when this is tested in a financial downturn. At PIMCO, we've added resources, talent to our multi-sector credit teams to stand ready for when that volatility comes, given the significant growth in both the loan and private credit markets. Today, dispersion in credit markets is very high. And, you know, I would say that diverse pools of capital are good for both issuers and lenders that can price it accordingly.
We wanted to ask about PIMCO's role in working with issuers. At PIMCO, you talk about creating the bonds you want to buy. Working with issuers is kind of a PIMCO specialty. Can you give an example of that?
Sure. So it's been an opportunity for us to work with issuers, in some cases sponsors directly in sectors and companies that we prefer, and sometimes in less loved by the market sectors as well. You know, one example would be, you know, just to take it back for a moment, during the peak COVID crisis, we had a retailer come to us. You know, as an industry, we've been underweight. We had been concerned about the lower brick and mortar foot traffic, the fact that during peak COVID, you know, many of these stores were completely closed. You know, for the issuer, it was cost prohibitive for them to be able to issue a unsecured bond. And so they came to us and said, you know, essentially, is there a scenario where you'd buy these secured bonds? And so we teamed up our corporate credit analyst and our mortgage analyst, where the corporate credit analyst looked at the intellectual property of the company. The mortgage analyst analyzed kind of, you know, what does the dark value look like on their headquarters and other buildings that they owned. And we essentially were able to help them come to market with a three tranche secure deal where, you know, PIMCO was an anchor and we felt it had enough downside protection from covenants and the secure collateral package, but still would be able to participate from the reopening trade and that theme in COVID from the upside. In fact, you know, these bonds were issued with an 8% handle and a year and a half or so later refinanced on an unsecured basis with a 3% handle. So it really does help, you know, to be able to sharpen our pencils, work with issuers, you know, put our platform, you know, the breadth and the depth of it to work to find those opportunities. You know, many of our analysts have had relationships with a lot of these management teams for some time as well. You know, we see these reverse inquiry opportunities or, you know, being proactive on our end for helping issuers find a solution to, say, their short-term debt needs or really helping them grow into their capital structure is one which really benefits our investors in the end with either an outsized allocation or a solution to holdings that may have been in jeopardy otherwise.
So, Sonali, thinking about your outlook and how you're positioned right now, what are some of the biggest risks out there that you're monitoring?
I would say let's take it from a macro and a micro perspective. So from a macro perspective, clearly for fixed income, one of the worst scenarios would be a repeat of 2022, right? Where, say, inflation reaccelerates, rates and spreads don't diversify and both widen. You know, that's not our base case, but certainly that would be a concern. Geopolitical risk rising can be a concern. From a micro perspective, I'd say, you know, kind of back to your question on rolling recessions, you know, there's pockets of risk, absolutely, even in today's market. Even with a forecasted, you know, average default rate, we're quite concerned about some of these companies in the telecom and wireline industries where, you know, they're large issuers of debt. They have high levels of CapEx. Capital is expensive today, and competition is also increasing. So how those companies navigate 2024 will be quite critical for performance in those high-yield companies.
So we wanted to ask about the U.S. fiscal situation. This is an election year. Government spending has been trending up for a while. The long-term risk is that a lot of, you know, market watchers are ringing the alarm bells about U.S. debt and the GDP ratio climbing. So can you talk about how PIMCO is assessing that risk and, you know, how that affects its portfolio composition?
Yeah. So during peak COVID, it was quite important that we had the fiscal policy and monetary policy be supportive. But today that's led to a significant amount of debt on public balance sheets and having taken some of that risk away from the private markets, right? If you look at, you know, the Fed had not stepped in during the great financial crisis for corporate credit markets and had offered up to $750 billion across primary and secondary markets during the peak COVID experience. Although they only needed to use $14 billion of that, it was certainly a significant signal. And one where now today, you know, we're looking at very high debt to GDP ratios in many countries, and, you know, navigating those next steps will be very important.
So you're an ETF manager now. Why did PIMCO launch a multi-sector ETF?
You know, we had client interest in the vehicle type, and we wanted to make sure that, you know, we offered our clients access to the breadth and depth of the PIMCO platform across asset classes. You know, the ETF in multi-sector credit is meant to be benchmark agnostic, one that's really targeting an attractive yield and can benefit from capital appreciation through, you know, similarly, asset allocation, regional selection, industry selection, and security selection as well. You know, the ETF, you know, has that daily visibility in terms of holdings. And so we're quite cognizant about the flexibility as well as the liquidity being quite important here as well. And so, you know, the team we've put together includes a PM from analytics, includes a PM from multiple PMs from the multi-sector credit team, as well as some specialists in single sectors, really just to sort of unlock that value in an ETF format for the clients that needed that vehicle type.
Sonali, maybe you can tell us, what's the biggest disagreement on your team right now?
You know, last year we had a very healthy debate about recession probabilities, you know, in terms of the right and the left tail risks, especially as, you know, markets had gone from expecting a hard landing to coalescing around a soft landing. You know, we were very cognizant of both tails and wanted the portfolio to really be able to withstand multiple scenarios. So, you know, we had been overweight, but through high quality selective opportunities, say in structured credit, in investment grade versus, you know, really reaching for yield and adding extra kind of low quality beta. And so this year, you know, some of that conversation has shifted as the economic outlook looks a bit more clear, although those tails continue to remain, right? In terms of could inflation reaccelerate and or, you know, could we be in a position where the Fed is lagging in cuts? And so we continue to kind of weigh both sides of this and still build a portfolio that can kind of withstand multiple scenarios. And that's kind of been key in the diversification as well as managing across different geographies and asset classes.
You mentioned behavioral economics earlier. How do you avoid, you know, confirmation bias and groupthink on your team?
Yeah, it's a good question, you know, and it's one where we're always looking for ways to kind of enhance the investment process with some of the key understandings from, say, that cognitive codex. And, you know, for example, when we submit best ideas as a PM team every quarter, you know, we do so anonymously. And really the idea there is, you know, there's no expectation of what is the person's seniority or what desk are they on such that they would have a strong opinion on the topic. You know, it really allows us to look at that with a blank slate. And elsewhere, for example, to avoid the groupthink, we do a secular forum process every year where we bring in outside speakers to help really challenge our thinking around, you know, what could affect markets over the next 3 to 5 years, whether it's demographics, AI, Ozempic, you know, all of these areas could be potential for market disruption. And we really want to make sure that we're thinking about them in the most open-minded way. And one of those, you know, aspects is we'll bring in the outside speaker. When they're done, after we've had a Q&A session, we'll actually send them out and have an internal discussion about what we've heard, what we believe, what are the investment implications. You know, and this is kind of a way for us to challenge kind of what we've discussed over the cyclical horizon in our forum process, and now kind of think a little bit more longer term and how the secular horizon could affect markets.
Sonali, thanks so much for joining us on The Long View.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for being here. Thank you for joining us on The Long View. If you could, please take a moment to subscribe to and rate the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number 1.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretschik produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. While this guest may license or offer products and services of Morningstar and its affiliates, unless otherwise stated, he or she is not affiliated with Morningstar and its affiliates. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Morningstar shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.